So good morning, okay. Jo Lord. So thanks for coming in for this interview on online with us. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. Yeah, surprisingly. Lots of things you've got to deal with, like most people at the moment, but finding new solutions. And very lucky to live in the countryside, so access to getting outside isn't too difficult, and social distancing has been pretty easy. So yeah, it's okay.
So who are you and what do you do?
Okay, I'm Jo, and I used to be a potter for 20 years. So lots of little mobility issues of my own from being in fixed positions on potting wheel and stuff. Changed direction a few times and ended up as a personal trainer and a spinning instructor. So I'm now level 3 elite spinning instructor, personal trainer level 3, biomechanics coach, and a leader in running fitness. So I run myself and I bike and I do a lot of spinning. So I'm pretty active most of the time. But becoming a biomechanics coach kind of flipped everything in the way that I deal with my clients now.
Okay, well, we'll get into that a little bit more. Yeah. But something, one of the reasons I love, you know, I really wanted to talk to you and is that sort of, I think you and I have that same kind of Katie Bowman perspective in terms of movement. Yeah. You know, the biomechanist who wrote the movie DNA, and the idea of just being outdoors, being out with the dog, climbing up mountains. There he is. Is it he or is she?
There he is. We've got that moment, yeah, where the partner
speak
rushes down and gets
of the devil. Dog. He heard
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And so obviously seeing you outside and knowing that you, like me, you know, we really enjoy being outside.
Yeah, absolutely.
And obviously saying about you live out in the countryside. So how for you as a biomechanics coach, personal trainer, spinning instructor, and then being in the countryside and loving the outdoors, how has the lockdown affected you professionally and personally, if at all?
Okay. Massively on both sides. But some really good stuff has come out of it, which I feel incredibly guilty about quite a lot of the time.
Right.
Which is ridiculous. We were talking about it last night, that I just feel this guilt that I'm enjoying some aspects of this when other people are having such a bad time, you know. But I, as soon as I knew what was going to happen, my spinning studio, which I'd opened last September, where I started doing some other classes in as well. And luckily, I only pay for the hour by it, so I haven't had to keep paying masses of rent or sort all that side of thing out. So that's been good. But as soon as I knew what was going to happen, I rented all my bikes out to my class. So there's 16 bikes out there, plus people on turbo trainers. And then they've all signed up to do 2 classes a week. So I have a secret location where I have my bike and my partner's bike, and I do virtual classes, and they have a private Facebook page that they log into. And in many ways, it's really improved my teaching, and I'm actually getting used to just talking to the back of a tablet, because to start with, I looked at myself, but then the spinning banner was the wrong way around, so we flipped it around. And I've really enjoyed doing them. And you still feel in contact because people are putting little comments up as you're going, and the feedback has been amazing. Still doing some personal training, but doing that through Zoom. I miss my running group because it was very sociable, and because I predominantly work with women, and the running group was a women's running group. And we sorted so much stuff out on those runs. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
And particularly as someone who has, as you know, like menopausal, then a lot of them are younger than me. So I've been able to sort of help them. And so it's become a big topic of conversation now, which people never used to really talk about. So that's all of that. We miss that. And we're going to try and do like a little Zoom thing together. But so socially, it's quite hard, but work-wise, I've managed to keep it ticking along. And because of where we live, it's been easy to go out for walks. I've been out on my bike a couple of times. I've lost my running mojo completely, but I'm not too worried because I'm doing other stuff. And I think we can overload ourselves with what we think we should be doing, and then it's just too much. So it's kind of like just do what you can, really. And if we've got a minute, I've got a menopause update.
Oh, well, we'll do that. We'll do that later on. Make a note and we'll go to that. But I think you hit on a really key thing. And actually, I've been pondering over it myself because of this webinar I'm doing tomorrow, which is 5 steps to successful online presence.
Yeah.
And what I'm super aware of, as you've just mentioned, is that there's these two kind of considerations. Like, I'm trying to be really positive, motivational, you know, this is a great opportunity. And then I kind of like have this, you know, slam on the brakes. Well, hang on a minute. Some people have lost people. Some people are caring or trying to care for elderly and vulnerable with very limited capacity. They can't give them a hug. Yeah. So there's this very bittersweet thing, which you talk about, the guilt. And I think where I kind of, where I switch my kind of like thinking from guilt is there are people who still need my help. And I'm doing that on a business level, which is why I'm doing this webinar tomorrow. So I shift my guilt into, I can still help people. And that's predominantly what we're doing, is trying to help, isn't it? So
the
way we can do that. I think we've got to try not to feel guilty, but maybe acknowledge and be sensitive in the way we comport ourselves when we're trying to be supportive and motivational, I guess. So
that
resonates.
I've done two, I did a lot in the first week. The first week of this, my partner said, I thought you were going to be like that for the whole time. Because we've kind of been forced into living together. We didn't, it wasn't going to happen quite this soon. So it's been interesting.
Yes.
But I was as high as a kite, because that's how I work when I've got to get stuff done. The rest of the time, I'm just kind of like, you know. But if I leave everything to the last minute and then I go at it, and that's just the way I work. I was completely manic, got all the bikes hired out, got the rides sorted, got everything set up, got all my equipment put somewhere else. And the first week I went running, I did a workout, I did my classes, I was online. And then the second week I just went, And then the third week, I kind of settled. Fourth week, which was last week. Well, no, I've lost track now. I kind of feel I've reached a place now. But I did a couple, early on, I did a couple of videos, basically of all the iMove Freely anti-spasm stuff. And then some basic single leg exercises for a course that I was supposed to be running in April, which was my walk to run. And a course I'd called 100% You, which was going to be a mixture of I Move Freely, spinning, discussions about goal setting, weight loss, whatever it was they wanted to do. So set up a little group thinking, they're going to be into this, the ones that signed up and paid. Did a few videos, and there's nothing come back from that group at all. They've just gone, you know? And I've just thought, oh, it's okay. I'll keep checking in occasionally, because I thought we could do it like we did the no refined sugar experiment, you know, have that sort of weekly interaction. Just not enough of them. And some of them are involved in other stuff. So I thought, just let it lie. Don't force people. Just trickle some stuff in. There was an article a friend posted today about how the fitness industry is actually suffering now because of the amount of free content online. Mm. So people are seeing their numbers dropping off on their paid classes.
I think that'll shift. I did some polls on my Facebook page, and I get that. Of course that's going to happen, you know, but there's only so much of you know, Sean T you can, you know, go with, or whoever else it is. And I think the poll I did was very simple. I don't know if you saw it, where I said, what do you miss? And everyone said human contact. You know, okay, there's going to be the same with the industry. I've been in the industry 30 years, and you know, there's always this fluctuation. You're going to get and then they're going to come back. I actually personally think, it was my next question actually, Jo, you've led me on to very nicely, is what do you see, what do you personally see long-term is going to happen to the health and fitness industry? So like, because everyone's very focused on right now, panic mode, you know, Kubler-Ross stage one, two, you know, you're clearly getting into stage three, and everyone's got different coping mechanisms. So everyone's dealing with it differently, but I'm trying to think, I'm trying to help you. You've got to think long-term and people are going to have health issues and they're going to need our help, but it might be different. So what, how do you feel about it? Have you thought about it?
Well, because I'm also doing the diploma with Mike at the moment, the movement therapy diploma. When I finish that, that's a real nice package of skills, hopefully. And I have a long-term plan for that, and always had.
Right.
So that I think will still happen at some point. So human contact, I think, is really important. Trying to assess people online is really difficult. And I think you've got to have a high level of experience to be able to do that and get it right and not misdiagnose and not try and do things that you shouldn't be doing with people. It's very easy. I had a friend yesterday who'd fallen off a horse, and she sent me a picture of her bruise and was saying that it hurts when she runs, but she can do everything else. So just don't run, you know, just don't run for now. And then we did a whole sort of assessment of, so at what point does the foot contact the ground, where it hurts somewhere else, and all this kind of stuff. And in the end, it was like, I said to her, this is beyond you need to get someone to see you if it persists, because I can only give you some advice, but I can't see you, and I can't touch you, and I can't feel, because it's an incredibly, you can visually see somebody, as we know, like you can give a visible sort of appraisal of someone as they come in and say, oh yeah, their shoulders like that or whatever, but they might, that might not be affecting them at all. That's not what they've come in about, or maybe that is what they've come in about and it's actually something else. And you can only really tell that by touch, movement, talking to them a little bit more.
And even down to the whole oxytocin thing, one of the things I'm craving is a massage, and I think more so because I know that's the one thing I cannot access. So for me, it comes second after getting my eyelashes done. I've got to my eyelashes and a massage, they're the first two things in the booking. Where I need to go back to two businesses that may be concerned about their future, and I'm like, trust me, that's the first thing I'm going back to. So
I think the same with, there are some businesses that I think as soon as we can go back to normal will do very well, and that's hairdressers. I have actually cut my own. I'm quite impressed, really. I've no idea what's going on around the back because my partner did that, but but hairdressers, massage therapists, I think sports injury, all those sorts of people, I think will actually see a rise in their one-to-one contact. And I mean, I know some hairdressers who have been taking a course on managing hair in this, with viruses or with, in this sort of situation. And they're actually getting a qualification in something, because I think people realize this might not be the first time this happens. And, you know, we may actually 100% have to change the way we operate forever.
I agree. That's kind of where I'm trying to think, is long term, how does this change the industry, sort of health and fitness therapy industry that we're involved with? You know, long term, what is it going to look like?
I mean, I think what's interesting is that when people are doing online classes, and I'm talking about the ones that I'm doing, like the paid ones, you are very much, like with my personal training, they're working harder than they do when I'm there, interestingly enough. It's very much more focused. you know, we don't sort of chat quite so much, and it's like they want to get on with it and then get off onto the next thing. And some of them are instructors themselves, so they've got stuff to do. But because it's so one-to-one sort of focused on the screen,
yeah,
I think people are going to want that outside as well. So even group classes may increase, but I'm not sure whether just going to the gym and working out will stay the same or drop or whatever. I just think
we're going to have more options. And what I would like to see is the industry sort of taking advantage of an opportunity to involve more people around the UK in movement options, movement options. And I think I've been working with the Her Spirit app, and the beauty of the app is their main demographic is the 50 plus female who does not want to go. They're intimidated by a gym.
Yeah.
They don't want to go to a gym, but they want coaching. They don't even put their videos on. So we don't see them. And that's how they want to. So they want to get involved, but they need platforms that enable them to do that in their own time, in their home, without being seen, maybe initially at least. So I think it's an opportunity for more scope to reach more people and get more people more active, the whole UK active motto.
But it has to change the level and the type of training people get, because there is so much rubbish out there and there's so much generic stuff that's not catered towards the individual. The one fear I have about, and I have had for a long time, certain big names who do all the YouTube stuff, especially one at the moment, and it's great, it always gets people doing stuff, and they get involved in it and they got their kids involved in it, but there's no specific sort of warm-ups with it. There's no correction, well, correction's the wrong word, but there's no, have you tried doing it like this, or you don't have to squat like that, if you're comfortable squatting like that, then squat like that. There's no kind of And it always worries me about the amount of injuries and sort of cause and effect that happens during those sorts of classes. I think small, and it was the way I was heading anyway, was small group personal training. And I did one just before all this happened, where it was called Spin Strong, and there were 8 women. And we did 45-minute cardio spinning, and then we did weight training. And I had people with back issues. I had someone with ankylosing spondylitis who I'd been personal training, and she by the end of it, she was lifting 60K deadlifts. And she, was told that she shouldn't be doing anything like that. And she's on her feet all day. But because it's a small group, you can help individuals and spot what's going on, and the progress those 8 women made was probably more than if they'd been trying to go to a gym on their own, which they probably wouldn't have done anyway, or just following something online, something generic.
You raise a good point, and it's one of the reasons I'm heavily involved with SimSpa, who are now the industry's sort of standardization accrediting body in terms of raising the standards in the industry, and they're putting together this workforce register, which I think is now even more vital, so that when people are looking for professional coaches, trainers online or wherever, now midterm and long term, so that the public, as long as they're made aware that these professionals need to be recognized, they need to be qualified. I think one of the issues is they're not asking us to provide evidence of our training.
Yeah.
And they're going with, I like a bit of, I won't name any, so-and-so's martial arts or whatever it is, or so-and-so's aerobics. But there's no requirement to say, are you insured? Are you qualified? Because I'm not sure they understand the risk factor. So I think where we need to get on board is to shout about, I am qualified, I am recognised, I am registered, I am all of these things, and be a part of that standardisation process, which I know Simsborough are trying to push through. So I agree with you, I think. But there's always been those Insta online kind of people who have no qualifications except a six pack and a booty. You know? So I think we as the professionals or the guys who are qualified should probably be more open and vocal about that recognition and saying to people, look, if you want to be safe, you need to get coached by somebody. They're charging more because they have value in that, that there's a value in that.
Yeah, but also even within the industry, like you can do a weekend PT qualification level 3 online, kind of, you know, or you can spend a year doing like a really good qualification that has, that costs more money, but you know, but you come out of it. And but even those, you know, knowing what I know now in terms of movement, like from doing the biomechanics course and from doing from working with Mike, it's, you know, some, even now, some of the cueing things that PTs use for people are wrong. They're so outdated. And it's like the industry isn't updating itself. It's not following latest research. It's not, people don't carry on training sometimes. Once they've got their qual, that's it. They don't retrain. That, you know, if you became a PT 10 years ago, you can still work under that qualification.
Hopefully that's going to start changing. Problem is, you can't change a culture overnight. Well,
no,
create a virus and then you change your culture. But you know, but I think you're right. I think that's all being a part of the industry with or without the virus. I think the virus you know, has shaken the industry up. I think long term that's a good thing. Right now it's painful for everyone. And everyone's trying to kind of work out solutions. But I think long term, it's going to shake it up. And you're going to get, like you say, this fluctuation of, okay, we might drop off while people think they can get it cheaper and easier. And then they get injured or they get bored or fed up. And they're like, do you know what? I want to go and I might go and join in now. I'm a bit fitter. But, you know, we've got to wait and see. But what do you think then, talking about, so your kind of expertise around movement and biomechanics, maybe specifically for my audience particularly, what do you think are the misconceptions, common misconceptions around biomechanics, posture, maybe from both the other professionals and the clients? What are the misconceptions do you think about it?
I think people think that as a biomechanics coach, you're just going to correct the way they stand. And I put that in with little, you know, and it's like, oh, my, you know, my posture's really bad. It's like, well, are you in any pain? Are you in discomfort? No. You know, why do you think your posture's very bad? Well, it's aesthetically quite often. You know, but if someone is getting some discomfort and stuff, then the trouble is that when people say biomechanics, they think of not intrinsic biomechanics. And in terms of posture, people think that there is still this balancing the book on the top of your head or sitting like this on a chair, and that's good posture.
Doing pieces.
It's and that word still gets used an awful lot amongst other professionals and people who call themselves postural experts. Personal trainers, they've had no specific training in posture. I probably know quite a lot about it, in fact, that I don't think there is a right posture, but this person would assess on the person walking in and standing in front of them. And that's not assessing posture. And it's like the right posture is the right posture for the thing that you're doing. So
it's a tough one. It's the differentiator, isn't it? Because, and it's like, I always view the learning process about human movement and the body as the level 2, level 3, level 4. You can't appreciate level 3 until you've done level 2. You can't appreciate level 4 until you've done level 3. And then you go beyond that, and then you start to go, oh, actually, I don't think we were wrong in level 2, level 3. So level 2, it's quads. Level 3, it's vastus rectus. it's just gradually learning a very complex subject, a piece at a time. Yeah. So then as you go deeper, you start to realise actually that's actually not quite the right way of looking at it. We're going to look at it this way. Because you can help people at level two and level three move better. I guess it's the higher risk and knowing a bit more about risk.
Absolutely.
Biomechanics coaching or the movement therapy education diploma, and you start to recognize, right, okay, it's not as generic as that, is it?
You know where I am in the movement therapy diploma. I am so far down the Kubler-Ross curve, you wouldn't believe it. It's like I come out of one of the weekends feeling amazing, and I'm not as nervous about that as I was doing the biomechanics. I was terrified. Oh yeah, absolutely terrified.
We've upped your confidence.
Yeah, but it's also like that whole school thing. I'm a bit dyslexic. It was never helped. I'm okay with my laptop because it sorts it out, and I'm okay learning stuff, but I can't verbalise it. And if I'm nervous, the verbalisation goes completely, and I can't remember anything. So if I'm put on the spot about something, that's it. And I got through your teaching, which was scary to me, but I learned so much. And being put on the spot and being made to think, there is no right answer, but being made to think what it could be, the way to look at things, set me on a great place to go on to do the movement therapy course, where everything's done in it's deep information, you know, and it's I'm surprised how much has stuck. So now if somebody comes to me with something that I would have done in a certain way with the biomechanics coaching, even though I'm only partway through the other course, I'm kind of looking at it even more as a whole, you know. And you also learn again what are red flags, and just to kind of leave alone. But I think in terms of the biomechanics coaching, there is nothing you do within that program that is going to hurt someone. It can only improve their movement.
Yeah. Applied in the right way.
Absolutely. And in that respect, working with with my walk to run group, I started introducing the I've Moved Freely program into the beginning of it and sending them home to make sure they did four sign and stuff like that. Not all of them, but some of them have continued to do that, and they said it's made a massive difference to before, after their runs, or just sort of everyday life. And it's just understanding the difference between mobility and flexibility, for one thing, how important strengthening is to their running or cycling or whatever it is, and also having understanding sort of a balance. So it's that classic thing, if you look up runners' problems or whatever, it'll always come up with tight hip flexors and weak glutes, always. And it's like you just want to bust that myth completely, because the amount of people who still go, oh, my glutes don't fire. It's like, well, how do you know? I'm a runner. Well,
upstairs. Yeah, right. Okay. So they must be working then.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. So it's kind of dispelling some of those myths and just getting people to understand that, like, mobility and a range of movement for what it is they want to do is important, you know. So even if it's the 70-year-old who wants to be able to walk to the shops and get up and down the curbs, like creating some mobility exercises they can do to help them with that, which is quite often to do with balance, that's their goal, that's what they want to achieve. You wouldn't put that person through a strength and conditioning course and in a you know, to make them a stronger runner when all they need to do is step up a curve and back down again. So there is so much you can do, but you need to also if you're going to do it generically for runners, that's fine. There's a whole load of stuff you can do. But individualizing movement is quite important for whatever it is that person wants to do. Yeah. And
I think that's the genetics, doesn't it? Like you're saying about no posture is the perfect posture because we're all physically different. So even if you've got a group of runners, you're going to have tall runners, short runners, fat runners, thin runners, beginners, more athletic. So while running seems like, well, it's the same movement, you're still going to have some degree of individuality, haven't you?
Yeah. It's interesting with running as well, is with gait and footfall and whether, forefoot runners, midfoot, heel strikers. And quite often some runners will go, can you look at my gait? Can you look at my foot? You know, I've been told it's better to be a forefoot runner or whatever. And I'll go, I'm not going to tell you how to run. It's the first thing I tell anyone. I'm not going to tell you how to run. I'll have a look, see what's going on. But by the time we've done all the exercises we need to do and all the strengthening, the mobility, you may find that your foot strike just changes naturally.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to force you to run a different way if that's not the way you run. You know, you can improve that and you can improve stride length. And if that's what you want to do, you can improve speed through training. But if you can do all that while you're a 4-foot runner, I'm not going to make you midfoot or heel strike or the other way round or whatever, and you watch some of the top runners, they've all got completely different styles.
Yeah, exactly. Same as watching a golf player. They all have different swings. Yeah. Did you do our running biomechanics workshop?
No, I couldn't make it, unfortunately, but I have been on, I've been on something, I think on one of the Kaizen project. Mike who came
did a foot posture
someone was talking about running.
Martin did it, yeah.
Martin, yeah, that's right, yeah. So
we've just put that online, actually, the running biomechanics, because there's a lot of science behind what Martin does really well is looks at the evidence for and against forefoot, for and against heel strike, for and against pose running, for and against barefoot, which are the common ones. And actually the injury rate between forefoot and rear foot, the actual rate of injury is about the same.
Yeah.
The type of injury changes ankle to knee, depending on what it is.
Yeah.
So, I think there's that extrinsic biomechanics view, and then what we get into, that's, I guess, the differentiator, isn't it? Is we understand the intrinsic performance of the subsystems and how that makes you run on your toes or your heels, as well as other things like speed or surfaces and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like road running. I do it when I have to, but I'm a trail runner and I like just getting out on, especially woodland and uneven ground and hills. And I love running downhill. And that's my thing.
Downhill. What's that about? Everyone hates it.
I know.
I fly down, and everyone overtakes me going up a hill. I'm so slow.
Me too.
I'm so slow anyway. But I loved, I mean, I'd pick it up. But interesting that. Yeah.
I mean, if you give me a vertical muddy slope, as long as I can trust my shoes, I'm off.
Yeah.
And having to yell at people to get out of the way. And I think what it is that people try and break.
Yeah.
They try and stop their speed. Yeah, instead of just going for it and trusting. The other thing is, because I've just done a running with a head torch series of 10 weeks over the winter. So a women's group again, because people are scared of going out at night running. So it's nice to do it in a group, but you need to learn to run with a head torch. And there is a skill to it.
Yes.
Well, not skill, but there is a, and the interesting thing is, fewer people seem to fall over running with a head torch in the dark in the middle of a wood than they would do in the daylight, because you fix your beam about, 3 meters, maybe 4 meters ahead. You've already processed what you're going to do by the time you get there. You just don't have to overthink it. And because you can only see that far with the beam, you trust it.
Yeah.
Whereas quite often people tend to look down at their feet.
Yeah.
And that's when they fall over because they haven't seen what's coming ahead.
Yeah.
So it's that was really good fun. That was really nice to take them out.
I've heard of training to use a headlight, but thinking about when I've done it, I generally don't run in the dark. I run in the morning, but obviously through the winter it is darker in the mornings. But yeah, I'd never thought of actually teaching somebody how to use it. I kind of do that instinctively, but somebody may not. Yeah. So yeah, that's interesting.
And especially it's like we took them up right into the woods, into the hills, into the muddy little single tracks, and you know, they never thought they'd be able to do that. And when you see a load of sheep at night with the reflecting back off your headlights, it's really quite creepy. But back to sort of what we were saying about what people expect from a biomechanics coach, is I don't think people know.
No.
And once they experience what you do and it helps them, then there's a greater understanding. But getting them to continue to do the things that you've taught them is really difficult. So you can only show people, prove to them that it actually helps. And then, you know, it's kind of up to them, really. It's getting things into people's everyday life. I've got a client who, she hurt her back doing gardening, and they're doing a lot of gardening at the moment on a slope. So she basically pulled a QL, and which is quite, you know, reaching across and so on. So we did a load of exercises, and I'm always got my stick handy. Love my stick. So that's another bit of equipment. Every single one of my runners has one of these now. We do it a lot for thoracic rotation and just generally creating mets or anti-spasms, just using the pole pushing back and pushing in, and a little bit of muscle release like that, rather than having to find a wall or whatever. You can do a lot with these. But we had a whole load of exercises for her to do, and she said she forgot to do them the other day after she'd been gardening, and she could hardly move all night in bed. But every time she does the release exercises before she goes to bed, she sleeps okay.
You know? Yeah, it's often when they forget to do them, they realise they miss them, isn't it?
So. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, but the percentage of people that continue, even though they know it works, is quite small at the moment.
And I think that's, you know, it's about A, choosing the right client, because I know that I pick my clients. They don't pick me. They initially come to me, but then I interview them and decide who I'm going to take on. Because some people do want that quick fix, which long-term doesn't work more often than not. And so what we're about is that kind of long-term idea. And so I think it is a different way of doing things. And if they don't get what they expect, there's also it's almost that automatic disappointment, even though it's right. It's like, oh, I'm just fixing. Yeah. So it is a challenge, but I mean, I interview people and I choose. So, so what would be, I don't know if you're a book nerd or not. I'm imagining you are. Give me your favourite book recommendation, audio or real hardback?
Oh. Gosh, do you mean to do with fitness and or anything?
Well, okay, two. If you've got one that's health and fitness related, and then one's just a favourite book.
The one that I found absolutely fascinating, because I love programs like Silent Witness and I love all that stuff. Although I love detective stuff and psychological thrillers. And I am very, very squeamish. And the fact that I'm even considering going to a cadaver day is, it's insane as far as I'm concerned, because 2 years ago, no. Now, I go through it in my mind, okay? And I know I'm going to find it quite emotional, because I can't separate bodies from people.
Humans, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And just as a digression, I'm really bad at this, I go off on tangents, but Mike had brought in a human hand that he got somewhere on the dark web, and I couldn't hold it. It was so dainty and small, and you knew it was a woman, and I would have said possibly, because a lot of these bones come from Asia, so possibly, you know, and all I could see was the person. I can do whatever you like with a plastic skeleton, you know. But
they've donated their body, you know, for us to learn. So it's kind of trying to have the respect for the cadaver.
Absolutely. Which was going to be my point, my book, which is the Sue Black book, All That Remains.
Love that book.
And I would say that is probably one of my all-time favourite books, partly because she really, her attitude to death was quite black and white, you know, at the beginning. But she also had this incredible compassion and empathy towards the people who donated, towards the families.
Death, lying and dead, doesn't she?
She
defines, they're three different things altogether.
Death, absolutely.
Dead, and dying, you know, and dying is the bit that causes a fear. Being dead, you know, depending on what you believe, but you know.
But it was an amazing book. I listened to it, and I'd recommend listening to it and having it in a hard copy as well, because you can flick through the hard copy. But because she narrates it, you feel very involved in it. But it also held my interest because she was involved with a few programs where they had to sort of work out what had happened to the person. So that kind of satiated my almost detective side of things, you know. And listening to that book was quite a turning point in me thinking, yeah, I can do a cadaver day.
Right at the beginning, when you go straight in with her description of an autopsy and then the very articulate way she describes, you know, cutting and dissecting and... I was like, right from the beginning, I was like, whoa, this, I could visualise what she was doing. And quite gruesome in places, but she's quite clinical and matter of fact, but with compassion, as you say. So it's kind of like a separation and yet, you know, fascinating for any body nerd.
Oh, completely. But anyone who just wants to, who's curious about death and just, I don't know, there were so many aspects to it that I'll be going to read it next time. But it was, amazing. But I listened to an awful lot of Audible.
So what would be a non-fitness, I mean, I would classify that in our industry, learning about
technically.
A non-fitness one.
I'm afraid it's very much the same, only... only fictional, so a lot of crime.
Right. Okay. And
it's always
crime, the real kind of like murder mystery stuff. You know, but similar, but from the same perspective as to kind of like, it's a different edge to what Sue Black talks about in hers. From the criminal level, I'm like fascinated by, you know, how does that work that you can do that to another human being? But okay, so anything else did you want to say? I was going to see if you would point people in your direction. So when it's going up onto YouTube, we could have all sorts of people watching it. If somebody wants to find you, where are you? How do they find you? Social media, etc.
It's The Hay Runner on Facebook and The Hay Runner on Instagram, primarily. And that's a really easy way to get in contact. And there's videos and little snippets and all sorts of stuff up there, particularly about running and moving freely. But we were just going to have a little menopause update.
Oh, that was the thing. I knew there was something else. Well done. So we'll finish on your menopause update. we are of that demographic. We're really intro. I'm Perry still. But what is the update on your research?
Well, 8 years in to full on, finally found something that worked, which was a patch. And it really worked for me. I didn't put on weight, which I had done with the progesterone and estrogen tablets. Also, they'd given me headaches and God knows what else. It was awful. Finally found this one. Oh my God, sweats stopped. Everything stopped because the sweats had become... that I was nauseous and faint every time one came. It was not just at night.
I remember.
Totally, completely debilitating.
Yeah.
And despite being on the patches, I noticed still a hormonal cycle, even though my periods finished when I was 50 and I'm 58 now. And I remember when I was at the last Casein project last March, I had a real total social interaction meltdown. Anxiety levels were massive.
Yeah.
The week after would have been fine. It was really weird. And that's when I kind of noticed particularly this sort of cycle. And then, of course, we couldn't get hold of the patches anymore.
So, the whole Brexit challenge, I think.
Yeah, well, it wasn't Brexit, apparently. It was supply, a very key component to do with the making of the plasticky stuff, I think.
Right, okay.
And it was a component from an animal, and the main source had some sort of swine flu or something like that. So then there was a shortage of demand,
right,
and manufacturing and so on and so on. So they said they would come back in March. So in the meantime, I had to have an estrogen patch and a progesterone tablet to give apparently the same balance. And it did help a bit. Definitely helped settle my emotion, because I'd been without it for 4 weeks then by the time they'd got it. I wasn't comfortable with it. I don't feel quite right. So last week I went in to get my prescription and there wasn't one. So I can no longer get that. So I've decided to come off it.
Wow.
And I am now awake every half an hour, sweating at the moment. Yeah. And I'm kind of assuming it'll be a bit like going cold turkey, and it may settle. It may be the extreme reaction of not having it might be
what it just takes.
Exactly. And then so there's I'm conducting my own experiment now on whether I can come through this or not and manage without it. Certainly when I was right in the middle of it, I say about 4 or 5 years ago, there was no way I could have coped without having something. It was awful.
Yeah.
I suspect, fingers crossed, that I'm coming out of it a bit.
Yeah.
I still notice that cycle. So yeah. I do note that, which is really important. And I would recommend to anybody keeping a diary.
Yeah,
not definitely filling it in every day, but just a note of when you have those changes, when you feel something, when your energy levels dip, don't beat yourself up because you don't want to go for a run, you know, that kind of thing. Emotional, and when you come out of it. So just keeping a diary and stuff. But yeah, so now I'm a week off, awake every night.
You could be grump. Well, apart from your partner.
Yeah.
And you quite.
Well, she's just starting hers. So yeah, we're a great household.
She's got the advantage of your guidance though on that one, hasn't she? So
yeah.
Oh well, I hope it goes well. It's always interesting to hear how other people cope, because it's such an individual thing. That there's so many variables to the menopause. And I think, you know, being open and asking people to see what they've had, I think that's the important part that we're both very passionate about. So I appreciate you sharing that. So that's brilliant, Jo. I've got another interview now with Mary Taylor. So
lovely.
Close. So thanks so much for your time. Good luck with no HRT and with your business and everything else through the lockdown. And hopefully I'll get to see you soon.
Definitely.
Time. Take care.
Thanks, bye. Rachel. Bye.